this while the Israeli regime presses ahead with its aggression against Syria, targeting more areas in a bid to expand its occupation of the Arab country. The regime's latest attacks targeted areas around the coastal city of Latakia in western Syria. Regime warplanes also fired missiles at a military base on the northern suburbs of Homs in central Syria. Fresh Israeli attacks also struck the Zainab district in the southern suburbs of the capital, Damascus, according to Syrian sources. The Israeli forces have entered village of Al-Mahriya in the southwestern countryside of Dara and are trying to take control of four villages in the area. Based on the latest data, Israel's occupied over 370 square kilometers of Syrian territory. The Israeli media's claim regime forces are conducting a massive preparation to stay in Syria for a long time, including in Mount Hermon. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman once again calls for international action to deal with ongoing Israeli aggression against Syria. Ismail Baghi, in his weekly presser, condemned Israeli seizure of more Syrian territory. He referred regime's invasion of a buffer zone near the occupied Golan Heights and continued advances into Syrian villages. Baghi also expressed hope for a peaceful transition of the government in Damascus. While responding to a question regarding the reopening of the Iranian embassy in Syria, the spokesman said the diplomatic mission will resume its activities as soon as the necessary conditions are met, which will provide security for the personnel. Now, Baghi also said Iranian presence in Syria was to fight terrorism and to prevent it from a spillover into the region. The spokesman said the future of Syria should be decided by Syrians and that regional countries must help in the process. More civilians, including women and children, are killed in Gaza as the Israeli entity continues to pound the besieged territory with air and heavy artillery strikes. 10 Palestinians were killed in attacks on the Daraj neighborhood in central Gaza, while 15 were killed, including 2 women, in another strike on Gaza City. Israeli warplanes also targeted the southern city of Khan Yunis, resulting in casualties there. An earlier raid on the Shati and Nusayra refugee camps also claimed several lives, including a young girl. Meanwhile, Palestinian Ministry of Education has announced nearly 12,800 students have been killed and almost 21,000 injured, both in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, over the past year. And since the onset of Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza in October of last year, over 45,000 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 107,000 injured. The World Health Organization has raised the alarm about the situation of hospitals in northern Gaza amid Israel's unrelenting strikes, describing their conditions as appalling. The WHO chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus made the comments after a humanitarian team finally reached northern Gaza's only functioning hospitals. Tedros warned Israel's relentless strikes on hospitals has left them without specialized personnel for surgical and maternal care. He added attacks have resulted in further damage to the hospitals and their oxygen and electricity supplies. And calling for an immediate Gaza ceasefire, the WHO chief urged for the protection of health care in the blockaded territory. The agency also announced its efforts to deliver desperately needed supplies have been repeatedly hampered amid Israel's onslaught. According to Palestinian officials, hospitals and healthcare facilities have been among Israel's main targets during the regime's genocidal campaign on Gaza. Families of Israeli captives held in Gaza have held a new rally demanding a ceasefire deal with Palestinian resistance group Hamas. The protesters gathered at the headquarters of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing Likud party in Tel Aviv. They insisted a truce between the Israeli regime and Hamas would help secure the release of captives. Protesters blocked a street in central Tel Aviv and chanted anti-regime slogans. Over 100 captives are held in Gaza. Around half of them are believed to be still alive. The families of the captives, backed by other Israelis, have held numerous rallies to press their demands. They accuse Netanyahu of deliberately avoiding a deal and prolonging the war so he could remain in power. Yemeni media has reported the U.S. has carried out another act of aggression against the country, hitting the capital Sana'a with a fresh airstrike. According to Yemeni sources, the U.S. aggression targeted the Al-Ardi complex in the capital Sana'a's Al-Safiya district. U.S. Central Command CENTCOM has assumed responsibility, claiming strike targeted a command and control facility used by Yemen's Ansarullah Resistance Movement for coordinating operations against U.S. naval warships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. The strike comes after a high-ranking Ansarullah member warned the U.S. against escalation of tensions, saying that Washington will open up the gates of hell on itself if there's an upsurge in its aggression. Iran's also condemned the aggression against Yemen by the U.S. and U.K. as blatant violation of international law and the United Nations Charter. Our Sana correspondent Yusuf Mari says the U.S. has fabricated a story about attacking the command and control facility operated by Yemen's Ansarullah movement.
Really, the U.S., Israel, and all of the countries that have attacked Yemen because of Yemen's stance with Palestine over the past year and so, they've only targeted old buildings that have already been evacuated, which is why there's no casualties. Nothing significant was really damaged. It's more of just a publicity stunt the Yemeni government feels by the U.S. The U.S. is trying to exercise and flex its muscle by carrying out these attacks and blatantly lying that they attacked a control command center, a military command center operated by the Ansarullah movement. This is just not true. There are no casualties. There are no significant intelligence, military equipment in these facilities. So it's just a way for the U.S. to maintain its hegemonic illusion in the region and to show the world that they're still able to operate anywhere that they want in countries that are adverse to spreading the U.S. and Israeli interest in the region. These attacks against U.S. warships have continued on a weekly basis. Every week we see 2 to 3 operations targeting U.S. interests, targeting U.S. warships, targeting deep into the Israeli regime's occupation, the heart of the occupation in Tel Aviv. They've targeted the port of Haifa. They've targeted the port of Eilat over the past weeks. And this will continue to be the case because, as I mentioned, Yemen's military forces and armed forces, they continue to advance.
A senior Russian general has been killed in an explosion in Moscow. According to an investigative committee, Chief of Russia's Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Protection Troops, Lieutenant General Igor Kirillov, was killed after a bomb hidden in an electric scooter went off outside an apartment complex. An incident took place southeast of the Kremlin. On Monday, the Ukrainian prosecutor charged Kirillov in absentia with the alleged use of banned chemical weapons in the ongoing war between the two neighbors. Russia, however, has denied the allegations. Joining us now from St. Petersburg is Jerry Byers for more on the story. Hello, Jerry. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in St. Petersburg. Tell us what General Kirillov's assassination is all about.
What we know about Kirillov is that he's the head of the Russia's radiological, chemical, and biological defense forces. He's been a bit of a thorn in the side of the Western-led regime to change operations in both Ukraine and in Syria. He was put under personal sanctions by the Brits in October of this year and was just yesterday named as a suspect in alleged chemical weapons attacks in the Donbass. Earlier in his career, he helped verify and expose the White Helmets fraud in Syria, and he's also shined light on these biolabs operating in Ukraine, which he claimed were funded by the Pentagon. And he even submitted proof that he said shows the connections. Earlier this year, he accused Ukraine of attempting to create a dirty bomb using spent nuclear fuel and other hazardous materials in order to stage a false flag attack and then blame it on Russia. Additionally, he's also pointed out that Ukraine's ill-fated Kursk invasion was focused on taking control of the Russian nuclear power plant located there. So, he's a major player in the Russian military. He has a lot of experience in dealing with defense of chemical weapons and terrorism attacks, not only just in Russia, but abroad. Certainly, he's an authority on the subject, and I think that clearly this made him a significant target for Ukrainian terrorism. And right. This isn't the first time it's happened in Moscow.
Right. Yeah, Jerry, Moscow has yet to say if they are confident that Ukrainians are behind this and how they will respond. There's what so far been no official word, has there?
So investigators are still working on the case, and it's a it's fluid development. I think that yesterday's him being accused and included in a case against Russia using chemical weapons, supposedly in the Donbass, indicates that Ukraine most likely had something to do with it. But of course, we don't have any verification yet, and we'll wait for the investigators to continue working on that.
Okay, good stuff. Stay safe, Jerry. Thanks for that update. Jerry Byers there joining us out of St. Petersburg. Meanwhile, the U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has criticized Joe Biden's decision to allow Ukraine to use American long-range missiles to strike deep into Russian territory, calling the move stupid. Now, Trump hinted he may reverse the decision upon taking office. Criticism highlights Trump's foreign policy agenda with regard to Ukraine, as he has pledged to swiftly end the conflict. Meanwhile, White House reacted to Trump's remarks, saying the decision was made after months of deliberation, starting before the presidential race. Russia has long been denouncing the U.S. and some Western countries for their military aid to Ukraine. Moscow says arming Kiev will only prolong the conflict. And now several people have been killed in yet another shooting in the United States, this time in the state of Wisconsin.
Three people who have lost their lives. Two of those people were persons who were pronounced dead at the scene, and one while on the way to the hospital. Of the six injured and taken to local hospitals, two students remain in critical condition. Their injuries are life-threatening. A teacher and three other students were taken to area hospitals with non-life-threatening injuries. Two of those survivors, have been released from the hospital.
According to police, a teacher and teenage student were killed and six others injured at a school in the city of Madison. A 15-year-old female student armed with a handgun has been identified as a shooter, but she was also found dead after officers entered the campus. Police say they are still searching for a motive behind her attack and what caused her death. Now, the gun violence is common in the United States amid heightened debate, pitting gun control advocates against people supporting a right to bear arms. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been more than 385 mass shootings across the U.S. so far this year. And now we're to the U.K., where activists have held a conference to highlight the British authorities' attempts to crack down on pro-Palestinian activism. Talks particularly focused on the misuse of counterterrorism laws and the prosecution of individuals and groups like Palestine Action. Issa Kadimi has your story.
As the Israeli genocide against the people of Palestine continues, several groups and individuals have taken direct action against the Israeli war machine in the UK. In August of this year, for example, dozens of activists from Palestine Action stormed the Bristol-based plant belonging to Elbit Systems, the largest weapons manufacturer in Israel, causing an estimated £1 million worth of damage and reportedly resulting in major disruption to some of the most sensitive elements of the factory for months to come. In total, 21 people have since been arrested in relation to the factory raid, many of them under draconian UK anti-terrorism laws, sparking condemnation from human rights groups and observers across the world. As a result, the pro-Palestinian groups have held a meeting under heavy security in the western English city of Bristol to discuss the British government's legal warfare strategy.
Campaigners argue that the British government's use of anti-terrorism legislation is not only intended to punish those disrupting the Israeli war machine, but also to discourage others from taking action against Israeli companies like Elbit Systems and others drenched in Palestinian and Lebanese blood.
Professor David Miller is one of the foremost anti-Zionist academics in the UK. He has been targeted by pro-Israel lobby groups that led to his dismissal from the University of Bristol, an injustice he successfully challenged in court.
They're trying to use any means that they can to attack the pro-Palestine movement. They're using hate crime legislation, and they started to use terrorism legislation. Yes, criminal damage, but they're also using the terrorism legislation against journalists and saying that some journalists have been supporting proscribed organizations, which is plainly ridiculous, but they are using the terrorism legislation, the Terrorism Act of 2000, the Terrorism Act of 2006, in order to suppress the Palestine movement. They can't find any other way of doing it but than using legislation which is plainly inappropriate.
For Professor Miller, the pro-Palestine movement is growing in the UK, and attempts to crush them will not be successful.
It's an intimidation tactic. What they're hoping to do is to convict some people of the Terrorism Act and say, look, This is what awaits you if you take up a placard, a slogan, if you try and invade an arms factory. You will be put into jail, and they want to destroy the pro-Palestine movement. And of course, they're not going to succeed. I mean, the outrage about the genocide is far too deeply entrenched in the UK amongst public opinion. Most young people in this country now believe that Israel has no right to exist, and that's a complete sea change from a year ago.
Britain's culpability in the historic and ongoing crimes of the Israeli regime means that many among the UK public feel duty-bound to continue disrupting and struggling against the Israeli killing machine's tentacles in Britain and beyond. Issa Kadhimi, Bristol, UK.
That's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we'll be speaking to a man that fought a 9-year-long extradition battle in the US, inadvertently becoming a cause célèbre and a symbol of Irish patriotism within the Irish American community. But before we do, let's get a quick overview on this week's topic.
One of the first goals of any Irish Republican political prisoner, they will inform you, is to strategise a prison breakout. While there has been many successes in Ireland's long campaign for independence, the more contemporary phase of the conflict saw a number of audacious escapes. On the 31st of October 1973, three Irish Republican prisoners escaped by helicopter from Mountjoy Prison in Dublin. After landing in the prison exercise yard, the three men, Seamus Toomey, J.B. O'Hagan and Kevin Mullen, were successfully airlifted to freedom. The escape made headlines around the world, causing an embarrassment to the Irish government of the time, led by Fine Gael's Liam Cosgrave, which was criticised by opposition party Fianna Fáil. A manhunt involving 20,000 members of the Irish Defence Forces and Garda Síochána was launched for the escapees, one of whom, Seamus Toomey, was not recaptured until December 1977. The Wolftones wrote a song celebrating the escape called the Helicopter Song, which topped the Irish popular music charts. In the aftermath of the Mountjoy escape, all Republican prisoners were moved to Portlaoise for security reasons. Not long after, 19 Republican prisoners blasted their way out of the jail dressed as prison officers. Despite an intensive search by Gardaí and troops, none of the escapees were recaptured and 16 were still free at the end of the year. In 1981, prison guards were once again caught off guard at Belfast's Crumlin Road Jail, where 8 IRA prisoners shot their way to freedom out of one of the most heavily guarded prisons in Europe. Some of the men were on remand for the killing of SAS Captain Herbert Westmacott. After holding a number of prison officers hostage, the escapees forced their way out of the front gates and made their escape into the surrounding streets. In September 1983, in what is now considered one of the most daring escapes in modern history, 38 IRA men overpowered guards and forced their way out of Long Cache Prison. Just 2 years earlier, 10 IRA prisoners had died on hunger strike. The escape was seen as a major morale boost in the aftermath of the deaths of their comrades. The jail was seen as Europe's most secure prison. It was a prison within a detention centre within an army camp, and believed to be completely impenetrable by many leading security experts. The escape, as to the many that were enacted beforehand, were seen by Republican activists and prisoners as a major morale boost in the psychological war against the British.
And with that, I'd like to introduce my guest. Joe Dougherty's story could have been written by a best-selling novelist, except that his experiences are real and he has lived to tell the story. A man that has no qualms in labelling himself a former guerrilla fighter, he has, like so many, made a major contribution to peace. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you very much.
Firstly, Joe, your childhood growing up, tell me a bit about that.
I grew up in North Belfast in the New Lodge area. A part of New Lodge area was predominantly Unionist Protestant, so I had really, really good memories growing up. Of course, at a very, very young age, you had a knowledge there was something wrong because the shipyards, I could see the shipyards and looking across the East Belfast where I knew my father couldn't get a job. There was Gallagher Cigarette Factory, the largest cigarette factory in the world. It was right at our corner at the bottom of Upper Meadow Street. Yet nobody from our community can get a job in it. We're talking about 10 to 15 to 20,000 people worked in there. So you had a sense that you were second class, but you had all your wee Protestant mates and you went baking and up the Cave Hill Road and stuff, up the Cave Hill and played in the waterworks and different things. At that particular time, I had a wee box TV, and I remember very well Dr. Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speech, Protestant, Catholics, Jews and Gentiles, blacks and whites, walking on the plateau of freedom and equality and all that. I was very, I mean, that struck me, it struck anybody, even at a very young age of 13, 14. But at that particular time, the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Movement was on. I was too young to go to the course, and I was too young to fully understand the intricate details of discrimination other than the physical ones that I seen. And I remember very well the Civil Rights March from Queen's University to the City Hall, very, very famous, and it was smashed up by the police. People were beaten up and blooded and people were being arrested. And at a very young age, I'm thinking, you know, hold on here. You know, we're marching for basic civil rights. We're just, you know, to get an equal opportunity to get jobs. And my mother and father couldn't vote at that particular time. And I didn't even know that until later on. And that's all it was, the right to vote, the right to democracy. After all, the parliament was the parliament of the world, and Magna Carta, and the writ of habeas corpus, the English gave us that, but it didn't affect where we lived. So that affected me greatly. Later on, there was a sea change in that our street with Protestants. We were very, very, we got on very well. But I think the civil rights movement threatened them. They felt threatened by that, you know, equality and stuff. So a lot of them started to move out. A lot of them stopped talking to us for some reason. A lot of good Protestants actually stayed there and became our neighbors even right through the conflict, and they're still there today. But there's that kind of sea change. And then I remember when the pogroms came and dozens of families came out of Ralph Cool and they came up to the New Lodge, including the Bobby Sands family. They went to the West, but we had a lot of people.
That's the Catholic families that were
Catholic families,
dismissed.
Yes, of course. And you're hearing all these stories that they lived there all their lives. They had great neighbors, and Ian Paisley come on the scene, creating a lot of panic within the area, what the civil rights marches and what this means for Protestant culture and equality and things they got there. Spooked up a lot of people. The few remaining families that was in Tigers Bay moved in. When they moved in, a lot more Protestants moved out. You know, they weren't forced out, of course, because the CDC, the Civil Defense Committee, came around and said, we don't want this area, it's a mixed area, we want you to stay together. But as they call it in America, white flight. Once whites start moving out and blacks start moving in, then there's a rush. So there was the sea change. Then, of course, all what was going on in Bombay Street and what was happening in West Belfast and the Ardoyne and hundreds of people being burnt out. We weren't affected as much as that there. But then the British Army, I remember the Army, it's the Queen's Regiment, they came in from Cyprus. So they're all tanned up and good looking big men and stuff like that there. And, you know, you were inspired by that because, you know, we thought that they were in to save us. But my grandfather, my mother's father, Alexander, he fought with the British Army on the Battle of the Somme. along with his father, my great-grandfather, Alexander Sr. And when he came back, he joined the IRA in 1920 and fought in the War of Independence. And I remember him saying to my mother, says, Maureen, they're not here to protect you. They're here to protect the empire. It's always their empire. And I remember my mother going, well, things have changed. And then, I don't know, John, just after, I mean, when I think back of it, you know, you were playing football with the British soldiers at the corner. They were coming in with dart teams in the local bars and the new lodge. And all of a sudden, you're being stopped from the school, put up against the wall. You're waking up at 4:30 in the morning, and there's doors getting kicked in. And people have been dragged out for interrogations and things like that there. This kind of sea change. A lot of the young squaddies would say, it's not our fault. We're getting orders from above to stop you going to school. Or, you know, see my father going to work in the docks, you'd be stopped, frisked, put up like that there. So, obviously, it became an occupying army. As my grandfather said, they're here to protect the empire. So you notice that. And there's a resentment against that. So I was one of the very, very early ones that, well, we were all like kids out throwing stones. Stones became patter bombs. Then I seen a sign on the wall in Victoria Barracks saying, join Provisional na Fianna Éireann. Now, I didn't know what provisional was. I didn't even know what that means. But na Fianna Éireann, I knew it was Irish, and somebody in school said, that means the Boy Scouts, it's a Republican Scout. So I made my way around, found out. So I was one of the early ones to join na Fianna Éireann. Yeah, I remember the blue flag with orange sunburst, and that meant a new generation. Put her left hand, it was a pistol, the first time I ever seen a gun, beside police and army. Actually, a revolver on the thing. We had to touch the revolver and the flag, put her right hand up and swear allegiance to the sovereignty of the Republic. We were paraphrasing it back. Didn't understand a word of it. It was all jumbled to me, all this patriotic kind of phrase that was put out, but we just repeated it. And the armor says, there's two things that it's going to happen to you, Joe. It was me and another two fellas, not mentioning her name. Says, yeah, you're going to go to jail or you're going to go to Milltown and the grave. That's the path ahead of you. You have an opportunity to leave and you want to leave now. We said no. So how do we sense the patriotism and belonging? Of course, they give us a very strict rule because we were Republican Boy Scouts. We were supposed to have purity of mind, soul, and heart. That was like no more cider drinking. We couldn't drink scrumpy or anything like that there. You had to be, you had to raise above, stand at the street corner sort of thing, because you represent the Republican movement and things like that there. Your values and principles now and things like that there. We were only 13, 14 years of age, you know. And so I got involved in the Fianna, and we were in support of the IRA, because they were out doing operations. We'd be doing scouting for them. We'd move gear for them. We'd do a wee bit of here and a wee bit of that. So they got there, gave them that kind of support. Then in January 1972, I was arrested. Matter of fact, I was 17 on a Thursday, and the next day I got scooped walking down the street, and the army pulled me in. They took me into Glen Ravel Barracks, and it says, do you know, what's your date of birth? And I give him a bum date of birth. He said, no. 20th of January 1955, you were 17 yesterday. So you're not a boy in there, and do you know where you're going? And I knew I was going. It was Girdwood. It was Girdwood, Palace Barracks, and Gough Barracks. They were the three major interrogation centres. And we were warned about it, what they're going to do, psychological, physical torture and things like that there. So I was taken up to Girdwood. I think it was two, three days kept there. You weren't allowed to sleep. They gave you a cot, and you'd be sleeping. If you thought you were sleeping 4 or 5 hours, probably only an hour. Things you got, you're taken and interrogated. I was stripped, slapped around a bit, and that's no serious torture, because it was two guys. It was Willie Johnson, I think, Willie Johnson and Patrick Fitzsimmons. They were being tortured, and I could smell the flesh. They were being burned. They had electric fires put on them, and then they got there. And I can hear the screaming. I mean, I'm only 17, and I can hear the screaming, and I put the hairs in the back of my head, and the smell of burnt flesh. Things they got there, it was scary. I was just a wee minion. I don't think they really wanted me to put me through that there. Probably had nothing to tell anyway. And what them two fellas did. After that there, I thought I was going home. They drove me down Crumman Road, Clifton Street, took a left. Then they took a right down Fair Frederick Street, so I knew I was going to the docks. Across the Queen's Bridge, he and me had an understanding where I was going, and that was the Maidstone internment ship. This is no British Army or British Navy ship that they used in the Second World War. They brought it to Belfast in 1969, 1970. It was a troop ship, moved the troops out. That was the new center for detainees and internees to be held. It was held there for 4 weeks. It's like 200-300 people crammed into this little boat. You know, you had like, it wasn't just two bunks, it was four bunks. So, because I was 17, wee skinny kid, I had to climb up a ladder to get into bed and things like that there. We had to sleep during the day and then go up at night and stay up all night. You couldn't have all 200-300 out at the one time. So we get fed at night and things like that there. So I was there with a lot of people. You know, held there for 4 weeks. Then I was taken up and was given an internment order signed by the Prime Minister then. That was Brian Faulkner. He was the old Stormont Prime Minister. Said, you're being interned. There was no charges. You couldn't get a solicitor. There was no prosecutor, nothing. They just give you a piece of paper and you were interned. You were detained indefinitely. 4 weeks later, that was my first time ever on a ship and the first time ever on a helicopter. It was a Wessex helicopter. I actually seen one the other day in the Crumlin Road. There's
Crumlin Road jail, that's right.
Yeah, there's one there. Yes. Well, that's exactly out there.
That one used to bring it from a Crum to Longcash.
Well, that's probably the one I was on. Yeah. That was the one I was I got photographs of it the other day, took photographs. And they took us from there down to Longcash. They took us up. Never started to get the nosebleed because it goes up like that very, very fast. They sat in to throw one or two of us out. They grabbed some fella, young fella, he was blindfolded. And they sat in to throw him out, that sort of thing, which did happen. The hooded men took us down the long case and looked out, and it was like six compounds. They called them compounds, it was cages. It's 100 men in these cages. Put me in the cage six, spent the next 4 or 5 months at internment camp. At that particular time, 72, all the talks was going this. So, Jerry Adams, Martin McGuinness, and Seamus Toomey, and Sean McStafford, and they were flew to London for negotiations. So they were doing little teasers. So every Tuesday and every Thursday, there were at least 4 or 5 people out of internment. So at the very, very end of May or beginning of June in 72, I was released. And that was up and coming. And when I got out, that's when I joined the Irish Republican Army. But that was short-lived because the 72 ceasefire came in. It was 2 weeks ceasefire. So we were all glad because we were taken up in the room and Sean McStafford came in and Martin Megan and thank you for your contribution to the struggle. Looks like we all thought the struggle was in. I wanted to go back to be a plumber, and people wanted to get bricklaying and taxi driving. And then that ceasefire broke, and I got continued with the armed struggle right up until the following year. I was arrested with explosives.
What year was it?
I was 74.
And it's interesting, you're saying that, you know, here's you 17, sorry, the day after you're 17 being arrested, yeah, and put on the Maidstone,
yeah,
going through all that and then end up in the cages.
Yeah.
You'd think I'd be a deterrent, but as soon as you get out, you join the IRA.
Well, I joined the IRA. I was very, very determined because when I was on the Maidstone, the Derry lads was on the Maidstone saying, there's going to be a protest today in Derry. That was the 30th of January, 1972. And there's thousands turning up because it was on the early radio, 11 o'clock. A thousand people have gathered up on the hill and they were about to march down, and then the next half hourly news, they're shooting, appears to be shooting at it. Nobody really knew what it was. 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and finally when turned on the news at 6 o'clock, the 13 of the protesters, people who are protesting against internment, us being interned without trial, were murdered by the paratroopers. So that had an effect on me when you remember all that, all those people like marching, protesting, a civil rights march, and people think. So that made me pretty determined when I got out that I was going to rejoin this time. I've grown up now. I joined the Irish Republican Army. C Company, 3rd Battalion, very proud of that, Belfast Brigade, and that was the new lodge in the north of the city.
During the 1970s, you were obviously involved in IRA work.
Yeah, yeah.
But you were arrested then in 74, was it?
Yeah, 74. Well, there was a report out there, but 74 was the major one, caught with explosives. That particular time had political status, so A-Wing was exclusively provisional, or IRA. I don't like using that word, provisional. We don't call ourselves that, but that's the name it was given to us. And we spent time in the Crumlin Road, tried to escape from the Crumlin Road, and we got a two-year sentence on top of our 10 years. So we went down to Longcash, and that was a great experience. You know, it was hard, harsh conditions, naturally foodways and dampness and cold and things like that there. But there was a great spirit in the camp. Then I got out in 1979. Cuey was dumped down the south, put them across the border. Then I joined the IRA against my mother's protest, because she said, you've done enough, you've done your bit, this is it, get a girl, have children, get married, all that kind of stuff. And you really, really wanted to do that, but I was committed to it for some reason. I just knew I had to go back. So I got out that Friday morning. I met one of the commanding officers, and I said, look, give me a couple of days here, I'll report back on Monday. And that's the way it was in the 70s. A lot of people went out and they got married and had kids, and fair play, that was it. But there was a few of us, a minority, to get out, and they continued on. And I joined the Irish Republican Army. At that time, there was no companies, it was active service units. So I became a member of the active service unit. I was active in that. Then we got I got word there was a team coming over from West Belfast. This was a really excellent active service unit from the Ballymurphy area. And they were doing an operation north Belfast with an M16 machine gun. They were going to ambush a convoy. It was Gerwood Military Barracks and Dunmore Military Barracks. And that was a main arterial route between them.
British Army convoy?
British Army. We were going to just hit the first convoy that came down the road. And we sat up. We get into the house, took over the family, put them family safely down the stairs. Myself, Robert Campbell, his commanding officer, and Angelo Fusco, we were up the stairs, and Paul McGee Dingus was down the stairs, he was the driver. We set up the ambush, get ready, and 1 hour went by, 2 hours went by, didn't know what the hell's happened. And Robert said to me, what the hell, is no traffic? So I looked at him, no, there can't be, there's no traffic lights. And one of the lads said, oh, it's okay, now there's a car. Apparently they blocked off all the road, and coming right down the middle of the Antrim Road was this car. So we thought it was civilian. And next thing, the car did one of them Sweeney turns, and five SAS guys get out of the car, and that's when the shooting started. The captain of that particular outfit, Captain West McCott, this was the Special Air Services.
Herbert West McCott.
They were in civilian uniforms, some had long hair, but they had orange armbands. That's what I noticed when we were shooting out. And he was hit. Dingus got out the back. He was grabbed. They wanted to shoot him, but they didn't know what to do. They were going to execute him. But because of the shooting, the heavy shooting, they didn't know what. They took him as a hostage then. And we quieted down. We all kind of hugged each other and said, you know, if I die, you tell my mother that Joe died. He was brave to the end. And back and forth. We're all psyched up. And the bullhorns come on, come out with your hands up sort of thing. So we waited. And then Robert shouted out, Fat shouted out, we want a priest around here. Because we thought we were going to go down the stairs and the SAS, they were going to shoot us dead. So we put the weapons outside the window for the cameras to see. So we were shot dead outside. We get a bit of propaganda. You know, we were all executed. But that didn't happen. We got out and we got arrested. We're taken up to Castlereagh for 7 days. And then on, but back to the Crumlin Road. So that was my third time getting into the Crumlin Road prison. So I was shattered. Fat Campbell had a good idea. He says, you know, I was in here before and have an idea how to get out. Now, in each prison, no matter where we are, whether it's America or in England or Ireland, north and south, in each jail you had a command structure. And the central officer in that particular command is the IO, intelligence officer. He was in charge of intelligence, of course, throughout the jail, and also to form an escape committee. Get a couple of seniors, men in the jail, sit down and get ideas. Through the wall, under the wall, over the wall sort of thing to get there. So we were restricted because digging a tunnel on the Crumlin Road was fruitless. Where did we put the dirt? Going over the wall because of the army watchtowers and things to get there was a bit more difficult. Couple of ideas come up by blowing the wall, getting explosives in and blowing the outside wall. That was tried one time. So Robert Campbell says, what about going out the front door? And everybody went, oh, saying, are you crazy or what? Going out the front door? And that was being the last. He said, but that's the last thing that they're going to think of. And I've got an idea. So he came up with the idea because he was in before and he seen something, because he had to come out of the visits to go in to see the lawyers who was up. So we built up the intelligence, and where was all the, what they call the emergency buttons, the red button, where they would hit if they were jumped on and things like that there. So that was planned out. So they said, right, Joe, your chore is going to be is to dress up as a screw. Me and the two Sloanes were in the cell, and Dingus was out seeing the solicitor, and information was given into him. So when he came out, I shouted out to Dingus, what's it like out there? Is it a good day? What do you think? Is it going to be sunny today? And he said, yes. And that was the sign that we're going to go on the escape. Now, I already smuggled the gun down. I had a gun in my boot from A-Wing. I had to walk all the way down. I had a wee 25 broken up, put in my boot. That was the scariest moment, because see, if I was stopped and searched, the whole thing was screwed. We got there. So like sweats run down your back. Went down to the grill at A-Wing. I got searched. They felt all the way down my boot, so I had to tense up my right foot. So when he felt that, he thought it was a bone, but it wasn't. It was a part of the 25, but he didn't catch it. Well, one of the things you got to do is when you're escaping, and it's proven in the 84 escape down at the Hitch Blocks, is you disarm the guard. You don't want to be in a position where he gets aggressive with you. So I knew he supported Arsenal. So I said to him, what about Arsenal? I heard you said ban a new player. So they get all friendly, so he's searching you down, but he's not doing as rough as he probably would. So once I got downstairs into the cells, I took the gun out. I gave it to one of the lads, one of the Sloanes. They put the gun together. Yeah, once Dingus said it's going to be a sunny day, that was the escape going. So once that door opened, I pulled the screw in, and we said, Irish Republican Army, this is an escape, you're under arrest. So he put his hands up, got him to take his tunic off, so I put the tunic on. I already had a blue shirt, because it was, you weren't allowed blue shirts in, because they wore blue shirts. So we got dye and dyed it, so I already had it on, but didn't want to be wasting the time taking his shirt off. And all I did was take his tie off, put the tunic on, have his baton and his keys, and I went right out into the hallway. So when I went round, we arrested the rest of the screws. They didn't know what was going on. They were laughing at us when I'm saying, get into that cell. And we had to get them in, get them set down. They were a bit confused what was going on, because me and a guy called Pete Rann, a volunteer from Tyrone, he was later executed by the SAS, about 20 years later. We took over the block. The thing was going on too long. It should have only been less than 3 minutes, and that was stretching on, because there was rats going on because of Bobby Sands and the other lads they were doing. Because we were going out right in the middle of the hunger strikes. Four hunger strikers had already died, and that's when we got the permission, because we were going to court on Friday to get sentenced. Our trial was over. We were going to get on Friday to get sentenced, to be sent down to his blocks, and then we went out on a Thursday, I think it was, Wednesday or Thursday. So we were going out. We just had to get out. We were determined to get out that door. So as I said, things went on long, because there was riders in and the families in, and then the phone rang right in the middle of everything. All the screws were down, their hands above their heads. Everybody was quiet. We had to go, and the phone rang, and somebody said, pick the phone up. No, you don't. It was upstairs phoning down to why what was taking them so long. Bringing prisoners back. And Robert Campbell said to me, go, Joe, you Pete, go. One of the Sloanes dressed up as a solicitor. He had the Queen's University scarf, the glasses, and the briefcase. So he just walked out, walked up the walkway until the, what you call the front yard, this is where the front gate is. And we just walked across, and I noticed about 10 or 15 screws, because the shifts were changing. That's why we wanted before the shifts. And they kept looking at me, and I go, fuck, they're going to spot me here. They're going to know it's me. No, but you have the cap on. They were looking at me like they must be down from the maze or something, as they called it. So I got to the front gate, and there's a wee tailgate sort of thing in the middle of the big gate. And the screw was on the other side. And I says, we need to get out. Where's the passkey? Don't have time. This man here, his wife is in the mirror. She's having a cesarean. We need to get him out now. And he's going, why can't that, Jimmy? We need to get him out now. His waist around there bleeding. So when I heard him click, and I pushed the door open, and we got in, me, Pete, and Ryan, that's when the rest of the boys come up. So it's Biggie McKee and Dingus and the lads, and we get in through what's known as the airlock between the two big gates, and that's when hell started going, because that's when I started nosing. Pete ran right into the pill box at the front gate. He ran in there. He was going to take the two army guys. When he walked in, there was six of them sitting there, because their shifts had changed. And when he came out, he said, there's too many of them. He had only four bullets in his gun. And so we just went out the front gate. I remember getting to the front gate, and this, he was an old fella, but he wasn't. I'm only like 24, so he was probably 34. and he wouldn't give the key. I'll lose my job if I give you this key, and we just went and punched the shit out of him. You know, he was like holding on to his job, and I go, big copper key. We get out of there, then we ran up the Anton Road, and the first thing I noticed was colours, because you're locked up 15, 16 months, all grey, and there's a big red bus and a blue van, and I seen the army across the street. They were outside the courts. So we ran up, get across into the Shankill, and that's when the two cars are there. But that's when all the shooting started, you know, so Pete and Robert had the two guns, and he had 225s, they had SLRs and cops and everything. It was like 65 shots fired. I don't know why anybody wasn't hit, but I just jumped up because I had the uniforms hit. I'm a police officer, And they stopped. I remember the wee cop saying to the sergeant, what the hell's going on here? Because all I seen was us running out of the gate, and I don't know why they were shooting. They didn't even know themselves. And that's when I ran through the Shankill. I ran through, just kept running and running, seeing people coming. This is the Lower Shankill, was just built then. So we got out at the Pound Lonely Club. We run there to give our codes for all our cars. The Irish Republican Army D Company, Lower Falls, they took over. Brought us around, put us in houses. And I remember Bobby's story coming in, and he said, what happened? I says, well, I know I'm out. I know I'd seen Tony Sloan run across the Shankill. I think Fat Campbell's dead. I think Pete's dead. I think Dingus is dead. I said, because I don't know how they get out of that gunfight, because they were just pelting that car. And they're crying, like, every time I feel it, Bobby come back in the horses, you are all idiots. And that was like, I felt guilty that I got away, and the guy who planned it, and the guy most instrumental, was lying dead, I'd say, at the courthouse. But it was a fantastic feeling that all eight of us get out. And it was at a time that four lads had just died in a hunger strike. And later on, when I did anything, I heard Joe McDonald was on his last breath. So me whispered that six lads get out. It was the first time he actually sat up in a long time with a smile on his face. So the escape isn't just to get us out, to get us free. It's a part of the struggle.
But morale.
Break morale. Break their security. We could break their... This is the most... I mean, later on, the big one at the Hates Blocks, like, well, 20, 38 of them went out, and then us eight, or any escape, is a bruise to them, because we broke the security. Most secure prisons in Europe, if not the world, yet because of the ingenuity of the IRA, because of our cleverness and our courage and things like that, we were able to break your system. And us eight getting out was great for the morale, because remember people saying, people, you know, were cheering and... people were, of course, the army came in and searched everywhere for us, couldn't get us. And it was good for the lads inside, because they were, word was coming in through the Hates Blocks, you know, the radio on, somebody would hear, eight lads get out of the Crumlin Road, and I heard that the lads were cheering. Even the hunger strikers who were going up to the hospital before they died, it was like a morale booster to them, and that was very, very important to us.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is very significant. That question is related to the expiation and elimination of sins. As you know, a lot of us commit sins in this world while we're here, and we make mistakes. And a lot of people ask, well, if sins are committed by us, what are the things that can be done to, you know, eliminate their effects so that they do not have an effect on us in the hereafter, and we won't be punished for them? Of course, there is a lot of ways that sins are, you know, expiated and eliminated. Some of these are beyond our control. Some of them are, of course, within our control. And we can kind of voluntarily, do them to eliminate these sins. Let's look at some of these things now. One of the things that omits sins and eliminates the effects of sins is when we are punished for those sins in this world. If we're punished for those sins in this world, then obviously we won't be punished for them in the hereafter. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "A believing man or woman will continuously be in a state of physical, financial, or domestic affliction, so that when they die, they will meet Allah with a clean slate." So, you know, these physical or financial or other kinds of punishments that we incur in this world, they eliminate the chance for being punished for them, for our sins in the hereafter. Also, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "No servant from amongst our followers," meaning our Shia, "who commits an act that we have forbidden, dies without first being afflicted with a severe calamity which expiates his sins, be it with regard to his wealth, his children, or his own soul, such that he meets Allah with a clean slate. Moreover, if any of his sins remain, even after that, then they are expiated by the pain and the difficulty at the time of death." What is more, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "When Allah wishes good for his servant, he hastens his punishment to the life of this world. And when he wishes bad for a servant, he suspends the punishment of his sins to face him on the day of resurrection." Right? So this hastening of this punishment is one of the things that helps eliminate the effects of sin in the hereafter. Of course, this is something that we have no control over. I mean, if God chooses to punish us for our sins in this world, so be it, and our sins, effects of our sins, will be eliminated, and we won't be punished for them in the hereafter. Of course, we might be able to pray to God and ask Him, "Oh God, you know, if you want to punish us for our sins, punish us for them here in this world, and do not, you know, give us a severer torment in the hereafter." Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at what are the ways that sins can be expiated and eliminated so that one will not be punished for them in the hereafter, in the light of the hadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key, an IRIB English radio, with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my son, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, son to you, see I
since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, somebody inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots me here, this land.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Islamic Revolution says the U.S. Zionist regime and some of their allies are gravely mistaken if they imagine that the resistance is over. Iran condemns Israel's seizure of Syrian territory and calls for international action to stop regime's aggression against the Arab country. And the Israeli regime presses ahead with a genocidal campaign in Gaza, prompting the World Health Organization to raise fresh alarm about the dire humanitarian conditions there. Hello, everyone, and welcome to World News. Our top story, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has reaffirmed the resilience of the resistance and said it is Israel that will see its eradication eventually. Ayatollah Khamenei further underlined the spirit of resistance. Figures like Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah remain alive, emphasizing martyrdom doesn't mean end of their presence. He said their bodies may have been gone, but their spirit, thoughts, and path continue to exist. Referring to ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza and aggression against Lebanon, the leader of the Islamic Revolution noted, despite daily bombardment and the loss of lives, the resistance persists. The leader also mentioned a Zionist regime's plots to surround and eliminate Hezbollah, but asserted it is Israel that will be